Hello and welcome. This is the first episode of Disqualified. I am, I guess, the host, Matthew. Who are you people?
I'm Tommy Bordeaux. big time Manor F1 fan, Nico Hulkenberg, lookalike in an alternate universe, and race car driver wannabe, I guess.
That's awesome. I am Davey Hazard. You probably know me from the Fake Racers podcast. You also probably know Tommy for that matter. But yeah. F1 fan since 2012. Massive Williams Martini fan when that was around. But then Williams kind of sucked. And then I was like, eh. And so now I just kind of like Sebastian Vettel. And I root for the drama. I'm that guy everyone hates.
Team Chaos.
Team Chaos. 100% in F1, man. That's the most fun part.
Oh, absolutely. Which, well, it's a good thing you love chaos, because exactly. Here on Disqualified, I'm sure there'll be plenty of it. This is going to be a show based around essentially just have F1 story time about failed race teams, which will probably eventually run out of F1 stuff to do, and we can hit NASCAR things like Angela's Motorsports eventually. But,
that's going to be a good one.
Sports car racing scams.
Yes, that too.
Yes.
For reference, I've been an F1 fan since about 2009. Davey, you said 2012. Tommy, you're around like 2015.
2014, 2015 was my 15 was my first full season. So
okay, yeah. And unlike you guys, I am a total history buff. I love reading about old teams, specifically the ones that you don't get to see a lot of biographies or YouTube videos about, the bad teams, the backmarkers. Obviously, cannot thank enough the former website F1 Rejects, which kind of beat us to this, but I thought it would be cool to kind of immortalize a lot of the spirit of loving failed F1 teams and drivers. So once again, can't thank them enough for the amount of research they did back in the day. But yeah, so today we're going to be talking about a little team called Scuderia Coloni. It was an Italian team from the 80s and into the 90s. And they had a very trying time in Formula One.
So, Matt has shown us. I think that the cars are very attractive. The logo for this team, probably the best F1 logo, team logo that I've ever seen. I think that is the coolest thing ever. It looks like it's straight out of the 30s through 50s era.
Yeah,
that's old school cool.
I'd get that on a t-shirt. I'll tell you what.
Dude, I would get it on a t-shirt, 100%. I wonder if it's trademark. I wonder if JTN can produce that t-shirt.
Well, as you'll find out through the course of the show, Coloni does not, I mean, the company still exists, but they do not race anymore.
Oh,
but
okay.
I'm willing to bet you could probably get away with it. So, I mean, that would be a pretty cool, parody team logo, like change the color a little bit and put like a different name on there.
Yeah, like colon or something like that.
Make it red, white, and blue and make it colony.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So yeah. So that is shall we just get right into this?
Let's rock and roll.
Right. Are you gonna give us a piece of information and pause for reaction, or is there gonna be questions? Like how have you formatted this, Matthew?
I've basically just got a script here. It's kind of split up into chunks, and if you guys can jump in at any time if you got any sort of questions or reactions or anything like that. So
I might get some like season results and stuff pulled up just in case, like just kind of ready to ask questions.
Actually, here, I'll send you guys my script so you can see what I'm working off of. Probably should have posted that. As you can tell, this is the first episode.
It's okay. Episode one. Episode one.
Send it all this out. Nobody needs to know.
Yeah. So.
No, they all need to know. Don't edit it out.
Our story starts in the 1980s. So the 80s in F1 was a very wild period. Turbo engines had been introduced at the beginning of the decade, and that combined with the ground effects style of aerodynamic design meant that the cars got ridiculously fast, but safety had not caught up yet. That's a train. So speeds were getting completely out of control, and towards the end of the decade, the FISA, the sanctioning body of F1 at the time, decided they were going to ban turbo engines entirely, which meant that all of a sudden you had tons of different engine manufacturers jumping in, making V8s, which then drew in tons of new teams, which all were like, this is our chance to make our mark in F1.
That gets me excited. I love the prospect of that. Man, it would have been a time to be alive, I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Spoiler alert, they all failed.
Even better.
Literally, the only team that lasted out of the mid to late 80s was Minardi. They lasted until 2005. They were the only one.
That's not much of a lasting impact.
As soon as you said Minardi, I was like, oh no.
Yeah. Minardi was the peak of them. So
God,
that is
so the main man of our story today is Enzo Colone. It's hard to find info about him outside racing, but what I do know is he was born in 1946 in Perugia, Italy. I think that's how it's pronounced. Enzo himself was a racing driver in the 1970s, and he raced in the Italian Formula 3 series for quite a long time. During this time, he earned the nickname The Wolf, which is where which is where his logo came
from.
That's
great.
That is so awesome. That's so badass.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Junior formulas at this time were running, I mean, they still do, honestly, run exclusively customer chassis. So you don't build your own car. You buy one, you plug in your own engine, or sometimes the engine is just like a stock unit. Put it together and you go race. It's more about how well can you manage, rather, how well can you design. Enzo spent a lot of his career racing March chassis. However, in 1982, he switched to Ralt chassis, and he won the Drivers' Championship at age 36 in a junior Formula Series. That'd
Folks,
be like...
It's possible. Don't give up the dream.
That'd be like... I'm trying to think. It'd be like Kyle Busch winning like an Indy Lights Championship nowadays.
God.
So...
which would be pretty cool, but you know,
it would be pretty cool. So after that year, he decided to hang up his helmet and he became a team owner instead.
Going out on top, that's the way to do it. I'll tell you what.
Just the Nico Rosberg thing. Just win your title and then just dip.
I'm not like hyping it up for the sake of the podcast. I already really like this guy a lot. This is so cool.
Oh yeah. So if there's one thing that's clear though, is that Enzo knew how to manage a team. In his debut year in 83, Enzo Colone's team, still running the same Ralt chassis, took Ivan Capelli to the Italian F3 Championship with a clean sweep of the season. Swept the season. Again, allegedly. That's what... Can't find the race results, but he outscored every other driver. Or he scored 91 points. Second place, Stefano Livio scored 33. So he tripled second place in points. So Ivan Capelli would also go on to be a F1 driver, which is a recurring theme. Colone had a history during their junior formula days of producing tons of Italian F1 drivers. The next year, 1984, Alessandro Santin won the title, this time beating Alex Caffey 52-46. Enzo wasn't just content to run in his homeland, though, and during that 1984 season, Colone and Ivan Capelli moved up to the European F3 Championship, which was essentially the equivalent to F3. Now, actually, I was going to say GP3, but it's not called GP3. It's called F3. So F3 is the equivalent of F3. Where was I on this? They missed the first race at Donington, but Capelli was on the podium for every race he finished, with the only times he wasn't was two retirements and a disqualification, reportedly over the car's airbox being modified. He won the championship in his first attempt with four wins. So clearly, Colone knew what they were doing.
That's impressive, despite not qualifying, being disqualified, name drop of the show. That's pretty good.
Shut up. If from a layman's viewpoint, if I didn't know the point of the show, I would think, oh, this guy's gonna be pretty all right.
Yeah,
nothing can go wrong from here.
For what it's worth, despite their lack of results in Formula One, like, Enzo always kept his team very well managed. He always seemed like he knew what he was doing. they just were a little bit out of their depth money wise. Italian or sorry, European F3 shut down or canceled the championship after 1984. So they returned back to Italy to run the F3 championship the next year. And like I mentioned, Ivan Capelli would be in F1 within 3 years due to the momentum of his championship success with Coloni. But 85 saw Alex Caffey, who was the runner-up in the championship last year, move into Coloni's team where he'd finish second again, this time to Franco Farini. Caffey also would take his success in this series and make a full-time F1 debut in 1987 as well. The very next year, another future F1 driver, Nicola Larini, would debut and win the Italian F3 championship with Coloni, narrowly defeating his teammate Marco Apicella and Alex Caffey again. I don't know if Caffey was still racing for Coloni at the time, but second, and third in Italian F3 in three seasons is a little brutal. Quick little tangent about Marco Apicella. He holds the record for shortest F1 career of all time. I believe it was the 1991 Italian Grand Prix. He got his debut and going into the first corner, I believe it was Eddie Irvine who ran him over and he got involved in this big wreck in the first corner. And that was the only F1 start of his career.
Wow.
So his what? F1 career lasted about 800 meters.
That's 800 that's, meters longer than mine will be.
800 meters. <So, you know. laughs> I was coming in with it. I don't know. I was trying. So.
Yeah, Marco Apicella holds maybe the least wanted record in F1 history.
For what it's worth, it is an F1 record. I mean,
yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, I do remember him.
There's F1 drivers that don't hold F1 records. I mean, I don't know.
True. I don't think about, like, I'm trying to think of an F1 driver who's not popping in my head, like Patrick Friesacher at all. But I'm like, Marco Apicella.
That's
okay,
a made up word. That guy is
real.
That's from Star Trek. You made that up. I'm
he's
sorry.
Actually, I only remembered him because he's later in this episode.
That's cheating.
1986 would be also be the year that Enzo Coloni wasn't just content to win his national championship because he had greater ambitions. They would set off to compete in F3000 at the time, the final stepping stone to Formula One. F3000 would later become GP2, which is now F2. So this is where if you want to make it to F1, you got to be an F3000. Running March chassis again, Gabriele Tarquini would finish 10th in the title or in the championship on the team's debut season, with their second car being kind of like an all-star ride with a mixture of Franco Farini and Nicola Larini and Alessandro Santin from their Italian F3 days, while bringing in Guido Dacco and Nicola Tassini as well. This would be their lone F3000 season until the late 90s, because Enzo had his eyes on the ultimate challenge, Formula One. They had won in everything they had entered up until this point, so it seemed obvious, let's go F1 racing. So 1987 would be the team's final year in Italian F3, although a switch to Reynard chassis and a lack of focus on the program meant that Ronaldo Capello and Antonio Tamburini failed to score points all season. But their focus wasn't really on their regional championship as they were building their first ever F1 chassis, the FC-187. Oof. So, as I mentioned before, the front of the F1 grid had been overtaken by smaller turbocharged engines throughout the 80s. For reference, in the early 90s, Ferrari would run a V12 engine, but the most powerful F1 engine of all time was a turboed four-cylinder BMW that Benetton ran in the mid-80s that pushed out, I think it was 1,200 horsepower in qualifying trim.
Jesus Christ.
That is freaking gnarly,
yeah.
Dude. Oh my God.
Yeah. Speeds were getting out of control, costs were skyrocketing, and the untimely death of Elio De Angelis testing said car in 1986 forced FISA to announce the imminent ban of turbocharged engines in 1989. That was still 2 years away. So for 1987 to kind of steer teams in the direction of naturally aspirated engines, the governing body established the Jim Clark and Colin Chapman trophies, which were essentially a separate championship. Like it's essentially like class racing in GT. So you have the LMPs and you have the GT cars. They had essentially set up a GT championship for all the naturally aspirated cars because they couldn't keep up with the turbos at all.
I didn't know. I never knew that.
No,
this was only a thing for like 2 years.
That's crazy. So.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
What?
Mm-hmm. I mean, they still got classified on like overall thing, but it was like, hey, you won out of the naturally aspirated cars this weekend.
Like, sort of like the thing they do. Well, not officially, but like the people do on Reddit or whatever, the Formula 1.5 championship.
You know? Yeah.
Not the Mercedes or the Red Bulls or anything like that.
Right, or like when people used to like exclude Cup drivers out of Xfinity Series results to see who the real winner was or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Coloni saw this.
That's wild.
Yeah. It was only like a 1 or 2 year thing because turbo engines were on the way out anyway.
Hmm.
Coloni saw this as a great opportunity to enter F1, so they hired former Dallara designer Roberto Ori to design the FC187. A lot of these teams during this era approached car design sort of like a kit car idea, where you built your own chassis, and then you would get a Ford Cosworth DFZ engine, a Hewland gearbox, and Goodyear tires. If you look at the results of like the 87 to 88 seasons, all of the backmarker cars all have Ford Cosworth engines and Hewland gearboxes.
That's because
it was just like the cheap mass produced way to build a race car at the time.
Wow.
Right.
They finished the car midway through the season, painted it in Enzo's signature bright shade of yellow, and set off to run a couple races to get ready for a full time effort for the next year. It was merely a test bed, so they didn't even bother building like an engine cover. The car didn't have an air box. It just had an exposed engine, and that's how it pulled in the air for the intakes. And yeah. So they signed Nicola Larini, former driver of their junior team, as the driver, and set off for their debut at their home Grand Prix at Monza. And one problem with that is Monza's a power circuit. And they were a naturally aspirated car in a field dominated by turbos. So, needless to say, they did fail to qualify. However, they were 27th, only one spot out, but they were 12 seconds off Nelson Piquet's pole time.
Was the track as short as Monza.
This prior to the 107? I'm guessing this was prior to the 107% rule. Yeah.
107% rule would come out in, I believe, 97, which will play an important part in a later team that we will talk about that I'm very excited for. Oh, gosh, where was I? So they were not slowest. However, they beat Pascal Faber's AGS running the same engine, but nevertheless, they failed to qualify. Two rounds later, Larini would actually make the grid at the Spanish Grand Prix at Jerez, qualifying 26th, final spot on the grid.
Wow.
Narrowly out-qualifying both Osellas, driven by former Coloni F3 drivers Alex Caffey and Franco Ferrini.
Hey!
That is one of the fun things I discovered while I was writing this, is how many drivers that started out throughout Coloni's history, how will kind of pop back up in different spots throughout their history, which is kind of cool. However, the young team showed its lack of experience as the car lasted only 8 laps and became the first retirement after a rear suspension failure. But they were not deterred, as they had achieved their goal of 1987 by making the race, and that was their last appearance for the season. And they went back to the shop and developed the car for 1988 for a full-time effort. So, Coloni's first two appearances had gone...
very whelming.
Making the race though is still a pretty big deal, I guess, especially 26 cars on the grid is a lot to think about nowadays, when I think the most I've seen is 22,
and
even then that's not anymore. That's crazy.
F1 hasn't had a full grid since 1995. Jeez. Unfortunately, so if like three other teams show up, they'll all make the race automatically.
We have not had, but you know,
we haven't had DNQs in 25 years. So,
wow.
So, with 1988 on the horizon, Coloni focused its efforts on embarking on their first full-time F1 season. Larini left the team to go drive for Osella and in the appropriately named F1AL chassis. That's so good. Still one of my favorite running jokes amongst F1 fans.
There's no way. Is that real or is that a joke?
That's one. You can look it up. That's 100% what they called the chassis.
That's incredible.
They named them all F1 or FA1 and then a letter, and then their 88 car was the FA1L.
That's incredible.
That's too nuts. Good. But there's no way. That. Yeah. Oh my god.
Awesome. Spoiler alert, Osella would be bought out by Fond Metal, I believe, 2 years later. So they didn't last very much longer after the fail. So
Poor guys.
But yeah, with Lorini leaving, Gabriele Tarquini, another Italian driver, became Coloni's first full-time driver. Enzo, however, wasn't the only person who saw the regulation changes as an opportunity, as BMS Scuderia Italia, Rial, and Eurobrun were all joining the grid as well. Two of those we will definitely be covering sometime on this show because they are fantastic stories on their own. Eurobrun was the only new two-car effort, meaning that there were now 31 entries for each Grand Prix weekend.
That's crazy.
So,
Jesus.
While the F1 grid is capped at 26 cars, qualifying can only contain 30 cars. So that meant that those new five entries would have to compete in what's called pre-qualifying.
God, this is so where cool.
it's like a karting race, dude.
Yeah.
It's a well-populated karting race.
So these five cars on every Friday morning would run their own separate qualifying effort, and the four fastest would make it into qualifying. So then you would have 30 cars to make it more manageable, and then the top 26 out of that would get onto the grid. So you had to pre-qualify before you qualified.
That's
if you were in those bottom five.
Amazing.
That's so cool. Yeah.
That is so awesome.
Bring back.
I didn't know that either.
Imagine if they had something like that today. I mean, the drama, it writes itself. You don't need storylines at that point.
I mean, it would be Indianapolis 500 qualifying every weekend.
Which is always phenomenal. Yeah. Wow.
Oh
yeah.
My gosh.
Imagine that, though, you show up to the track and you don't pre-qualify, so you leave like a day before everybody else.
God, that's crazy.
So yeah,
that is fascinating.
Yeah. So luckily for Coloni, though, their 1988 car, the FC188, was merely an update of the FC187. The car now had an engine cover. It had a steeper sloping nose cone, a higher seated cockpit, some repositioned radiators, but it still lacked an airbox, which was becoming evident at the time that you kind of needed if you wanted your car to run well. But because the car wasn't entirely new, they had a slight advantage over their pre-qualifying brethren at the start of the season. Tarquini was regularly the final pre-qualifier while qualifying for the race for the first five rounds of the season, starting 25th in Brazil, 17th in San Marino, 24th in Monaco, 21st in Mexico, and 26th in Canada. Tarquini was notably great at starts each week, but much like the season before, the car was still lacking in reliability. A suspension failure in Brazil, fuel systems failure in San Marino, and another suspension failure in Monaco meant the team wouldn't see the checkered flag until Tarquini finished five laps off Alain Prost in Mexico. However, the team would have its best result of the season, and as it turned out, its entire F1 stint in Canada with an eighth place finish just two laps off Ayrton Senna's winning McLaren.
It's not bad. Hey. That's not bad, everything considered. Yeah.
That's not points paying back then either, right?
No,
that's
it was
not,
only top six at the
top
time.
Top six, yeah.
Yeah. This was also the era where like power circuits like Montreal would see like 10 finishers. You'd have way more DNFs than
finishers.
That's
wild.
Yeah.
That's cool, but that's wild.
Yeah. So this was easily the highlight of their debut season, but unfortunately they immediately followed this by Tarquini failing to pre-qualify four times in a row in Detroit, Ooh. France, Britain, and Germany. Oof. Which means only one person fails to pre-qualify, so that is you're the slowest. However, the Hungaroring would see Tarquini make the grid once more, making it through pre-qualifying with ease and making the grid in 22nd. He would also finish five laps down in 13th, the final car running. The following week at Spa in Belgium, Tarquini would put his car 22nd on the grid again, this time reaching the finish seven laps down, but not classified. The hiring of former AGS employees, AGS, another backmarker team at the time, Christian Vanderplan, Michael Costa, and Frederick Dano I think that's how you pronounce that. Unfortunately, didn't help the team's growing misfortunes. They were very well regarded, but as you will see, Colony didn't have a lot of money or resources to develop their cars when you're building your own chassis rather than running a customer one. The team failed once again to qualify at their home Grand Prix at Monza, but they would rebound in Portugal with Tarquini pre-qualifying third, qualifying 26th, then seeing the checkered flag 11th, five laps down. But this would be the final time a Colony F1 car would ever see the finish of a Grand Prix.
You're kidding. Oh my God.
No way.
And this is... We're in full-time year one.
Wow. Oh my God.
So
that's incredible.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on. I'm not going to sit here and spoil it, but keep going. This is insane. What?
What is, if you want to think this is crazy, Colony's one of the better teams that we're going to follow on this show. So
I know it's an obvious one, but I really hope that USF1 is somewhere on this list.
It'll be there sometime. So
I know it's an obvious one. That's an easy one, but
ooh. Yeah. The FC 188 had clearly started to show its age and lack of development as Tarquini failed to pre-qualify in Spain and Japan, only to pre-qualify in Australia, but miss the grid in 27th, 0.045 seconds off Pierre Carlo Ganzani's Zach Speed to miss the final race of the season. Which that's got to be even more brutal, is to make it through pre-qualifying, but then miss the grid.
That's tough. I mean, because you just wasted a whole day. You could have been at home relaxing by now, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could have just sat there, got knocked out pre-qualifying, went home to press.
Yeah, saved a day.
Saved the day, exactly.
So, 1988 had started very promising for Colony, but Enzo and his team had very quickly learned how difficult F1 was going to be. They qualified for the first five races of the season, but only made three of the remaining 11, ending the year with four finishes, four DNFs, two failures to qualify, and six failures to pre-qualify. Tarquini had ended the season 23rd out of 36 drivers on countback, and Colony ended up 14th on countback in the Constructors' Championship ahead of Ligier, Osella, fellow debutants, Eurobrun, and the struggling Zach Speed team. Clearly, they had their work cut out for them in 1989.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Goodness gracious.
Things weren't about to get easier, though, because 1989 would see the largest grid in F1 history. It brought finally the banning on turbo engines was here. Everybody was running naturally aspirated engines, which saw the grid swell to 20 constructors and 39 cars.
Oh my God. So, okay. So obviously back then you could still be a one car team.
Yes.
That's cool.
Yeah.
and there weren't any, like, cause you can bring one car to the track today in F1, but they'll fine you immensely. Was it like that, or was it just like bring whatever you
want? I can't find the exact time that became the rule. It's sometime around 92 or 93 where basically this whole scourge of poorly run F1 teams made Bernie Eccleston kind of clamp down on who got to be an F1. Yeah. That's why it's so hard to get into F1 as a constructor now, is because you had all of these low budget teams come in and kind of embarrass the sport, as we will get to in a later episode, which is I can't emphasize enough how amazing this story is that we're going to be covering on a future episode is. But yes, at the time you could still run one car.
With no penalties or fines or anything like that. It was just, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. The F3000 team First Racing had also initially planned to enter, but their ill-fated entry was withdrawn after their car failed its mandatory crash test. This is the car also that chassis would later be bought by, oh my God, I'm forgetting the guy's name, but he formed a little team called Life F1.
Oh, baby. Oh, baby.
So, are you serious?
They took the worst engine in F1 history and bolted it in the back of a chassis that failed its crash test. And we're like, this is going to go well.
That's incredible. That's fascinating.
Surely people will want to buy our motor.
Oh,
so
Colony's looking pretty good at this point for what it's
worth. Yeah, like I said, Colony is like one of the better one of these teams that we're going to follow. So.
Oh my God.
Colony would expand to two cars, as well as Real, BMS Scuderia Italia, Osella, and AGS, though Eurobrun downsized to one. and the Brabham team returned after a year away, as well as the brand new Onyx team also made its debut, which meant that pre-qualifying would consist of 13 cars each week,
God,
with only the top four making it to qualifying crazy. Proper.
That's so gnarly. Oh my crazy. Gosh.
That's intense, man. I'll tell you what. Wow.
They're turning away a third of their entries every week.
At least you got friends you're going home with this time.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh my goodness.
It's amazing.
So for its drivers, Gabriele Tarquini left to join first, but when that team never made it to the grid, he went and took the second AGS car. And to replace them, Colony signed reigning F3000 champion and former Lotus driver Roberto Moreno. Roberto Moreno will more than likely be a reoccurring feature on this show, as he drove for 10 different teams across his 7 seasons in F1, as well as being a regular fixture in kart and champ car after F1. Moreno was a solid driver. I'm pretty sure he scored a podium at some point in his career. He was just the ultimate journeyman. Like, he would just drive whatever.
That's awesome.
He was just happy to be there.
That's cool.
That's really awesome.
So, because of Gabriele Tarquini's 8th place finish in Canada the year before, Moreno would avoid pre-qualifying for the first half of the year. Alongside him would be Pierre-Henri Raphael, a French pay driver who brought sponsorship from La Cinque, a French TV station. Pierre-Henri was a regular fixture at Le Mans and won in 1997, driving a McLaren F1 GTR, but his only F1 experience was a DNQ the season before for LaRousse at the season-ending Australian Grand Prix. Now running Pirelli tires, because I believe Pirelli took over for Goodyear as the exclusive tire provider. Pirelli joined in, so we had a tire war. The FC188, now named the FC188B, was rolled back out to start the season, as the new C3 chassis that they were building was not ready yet.
Couldn't get more creative with the car name.
Well, so the FC88B was just the car from the year before, but like mildly
with an airbox.
No, not even yet.
Oh my god!
What do you mean? They couldn't put an airbox on it yet?
No, that would be reserved for the C3, which is that those three designers who joined the team from AGS were building. So,
well, a lot of good that's doing them.
Yeah, Colony would have to wait a little bit to have forced induction on their car. So, they were a little behind the times. So. The car very clearly showed its age, as Moreno failed to qualify in Brazil and San Marino, and Raphael failed to pre-qualify in both. However, Monaco saw Moreno make the grid in 25th, and Raphael pre-qualified 3rd and made the race in 18th, qualifying ahead of former race winner Rene Arnoux and 3-time world champion Nelson Piquet.
Sheesh! Okay. That's all right.
Oh my god.
Now, it's kind of just like PK was driving for a really bad Lotus team at the time as defending world champion, but still, there's a great picture. I unfortunately couldn't find it, but it's Raphael coming out of the tunnel at Monaco with PK behind him. And it's just a beautiful picture.
You said that. And I thought I'm like, my initial thought when you said that before we started recording or before the show was like, oh, that's funny. He's coming around to lap him.
Yeah, sure.
And there's a picture of him in front of him.
No, I straight did not up know running at him.
He was just in front of him.
That's incredible.
I didn't know that.
If you ever get the chance, I think it's the 2001 Monaco Grand Prix. David Coulthard stalled on the grid and got stuck. He qualified on pole and then stalled on the grid and got stuck at the back. And he spent like 40 laps stuck behind Enrique Bernoldi in an Arrows. Like, Enrique Bernoldi, he was like, I know he's faster than me, but I'm just going to make it my job to hold up David Coulthard and ruin his day.
That's awesome.
And like, the announcers just like followed him all day. And like, I'm pretty sure Coulthard flipped him off once he finally got by. But like, Bernoldi was just like, I'm just going to ruin David Coulthard's day. So Monaco's great for some shenanigans like that.
Fantastic.
Both cars would retire from Monaco with gearbox issues. But unfortunately, it would be a false sense of hope, as this would be the only time Colony would qualify both cars for a Grand Prix, and the only time that Raphael would make it past pre-qualifying.
Oh, wow.
So if you're going to do it, make it worthwhile like he did.
Yeah.
So Phoenix and Mexico would see the team cutting back its efforts, as the C3 was nearing completion. So to no surprise, both cars failed to make the grid. But in Canada, the new chassis finally debuted, this time with an airbox. So
nice.
Stepping up in the world.
Yep. In the thread I made, that's the white, blue, and yellow car. So
yes.
I also really like that livery. While Raphael failed to pre-qualify again, Marino used the car to great effect, taking the final grid slot and qualifying 26th. While the year before the team had made the finish in 8th, 1989 was very different as Marino lost a wheel at one point and retired 57 laps in with gearbox issues. The final retirement. Man. Yeah, the final retirement in a race that only saw 8 finishers.
Oh my so gosh.
They kind of finished 9th, but not really.
Yeah. Wow.
The next race in France saw another DNQ and DNPQ for their two drivers before Moreno snuck onto the grid in 23rd in Britain, though he was the first retirement after 2 laps, once again with gearbox issues. God.
True. Oh my gosh.
I'll make them like they used to, I'll tell you what.
Yep. I'd hope not.
Dude.
Well, yeah.
That also marked the halfway point in the season, which meant for the British Grand Prix, or following the British Grand Prix, they redrew the pre-qualifying lineup, which meant Moreno was now forced to pre-qualify with his teammate. Lead designer of the C3, Christian Vanderplan, left Colony to return to AGS, not enjoying his time at the team very much. And after 2 more double DNPQs in Germany and Hungary, Raphael left the team and took a sponsorship with him to fellow struggling backmarkers Rial, and R&D specialist Michael Costa left as well. To replace Raphael, Enrico Bertaggio was hired, though he wasn't much better as he never once placed above last in pre-qualifying. So things are starting to come unglued.
Yeah.
It's all falling apart.
It was looking really good.
They had like this big spike at Monaco, and now we're back in the trenches again.
How quickly the dominoes fall.
They put an airbox on the car, can't get it together.
Yeah, take it off. Clearly it's not working.
Honestly, they were better without it. So Belgium and Italy saw 2 more double DNPQs before Enzo Colonna made a move to improve the car finally. Gary Anderson, who would go on to design several successful Jordan Grand Prix cars, including, if you've ever seen the Jordan 191, the 7-Up car, it's like considered one of the most beautiful F1 cars of all time. He designed that. He did all of the bright yellow Benson and Hedgens arrows from the late 90s as well. This is all before that though, and he would be brought in to improve the C3. At Estoril, bearing a brand new nose cone and front wing, they only had 1, and so they put it on Moreno's car. Moreno was incredibly quick, pre-qualified 3rd, made the grid, and 15th. He actually, in the first qualifying session, was 11th fastest. Oh, like, the car was legitimately quick.
Jeez.
Unfortunately, during final practice on Saturday, Moreno collided with Eddie Cheever's arrows, and they destroyed the nose cone and front wing. That's that picture that I put in here of him airborne. So, thanks, Eddie.
Wow. God, that's so frustrating. Imagine that. Things were looking good. They fell apart. They got a new guy in here. Knows what he's doing. He's got a better car. And then just like that, gone.
Yeah. Since that was the only new nose cone and front wing they had, Moreno struggled in the race with the old nose cone and retired after just 11 laps with electrical issues. Unfortunately, this would be the final highlight of the season for Colony, as they would double DNPQ for the final 3 rounds in Spain, God, Japan, and Australia. Which that's just got to be extra brutal, because this team's based out of Italy, and you fly all the way to Japan, fail to pre-qualify, and then you're like, man, that sucked. All right, time to go down to Australia. Jesus. Oh, we failed to pre-qualify again.
That's incredible.
So, things are not looking great. The largely fruitless season took a toll on the team, as by the end of it, outside of Enzo and his drivers, they had just 6 employees left and only 5 starts out of 32 entries to their name. Moreno finished 35th on countback in the Drivers' Championship, Raphael 39th, having failed to qualify a single time for AGS, and Bertaggio finishing 46th out of 47.
Not last.
Colony rounded out their second full season 18th on countback, one of only four teams to fail to score points, ahead of only Zach Speed, whose disastrous Yamaha engines resulted in Bernschneider only qualifying twice and Aguri Suzuki failing to pre-qualify a single time, and Eurobrun, who never qualified and made it past pre-qualifying a single time in the opening round.
Holy moly.
For what it's worth, at least they're doing... I mean, like we've said all along, I mean, the fact that this team, Colony, is a highlight is... it's sensational. I mean, really.
Wow. That Zach Speed season is going to be a future episode, too, because the story of how badly Yamaha dropped the ball with their experimental engine literally killed the team. Wow. So,
I love that one, man.
Oh yeah.
There's something about how, like, when the bag gets fumbled in F1, it's never just like a slow demise. It is an absolute capitulation.
It is spectacular.
Of everything involved. This is fantastic.
That's the thing that makes this era of F1 so cool to me, is like F1 now is ultra professional. Every team, even like Williams and Haas, who are struggling really badly, they look like they belong, you know?
Yeah.
And then you go back to the late 80s and early 90s, and it's like, what are you guys doing?
There's something pretty romantic about it, though. I mean, just the thought that, you know, all these teams were trying their best, and I don't know. I mean, failing spectacularly, but that's something beautiful about that. Just the essence of motorsport, and I think the lessons learned.
Yeah.
Perseverance. Look, man, it was a failure, but man, at least they tried. They were there. They could say they were there. And I mean, that's an opportunity that I don't think, well, I mean, obviously it's a very select few people that did at the time anyway, you know, comparatively, but I mean, now, like, this kind of thing can't happen, and I don't know. There's something just beautiful about even the spectacular failures. It's, I don't know. It's kind of heartwarming a little bit.
Yeah.
Honestly,
And, like, it really, like, it, like, stories like this and, like, the everything that's happening, it, like, speaks so much to the paradigm shift that happened in F1 from then to now. Like, how the imagery of a Formula 1, how an F1 team is, like, thought of and portrayed is just totally different. Like, I feel like the entire atmosphere of the sport, even just back to the early 1990s, where this is all occurring, or the late 80s, like the absolute, like, dichotomy of one versus the other, it's like laughable how different it is. It's insane.
It's funny to watch, like, Drive to Survive nowadays, and you see, like, the Mercedes team meetings, where they have, like, everybody has their headsets and everything, and they have all this data, and they're, like, analyzing every little tiny thing. And then you go back to 1990, and Coloni's like, can anybody here drive?
Hey, yo, so I need someone that can make an airbox.
Does anybody have, like, $12? We need tires. Oh my gosh. But yeah, like you're talking about, like, it would be so easy after 1989 to just be like, this isn't working, like, it's not going to get better, but Colony did not have that mindset, and they pressed on it in 1990, quite frankly, in shambles. But seemingly out of nowhere, a beacon of hope shone down upon the team. I might have used the wrong predication of shine, but there, with the new naturally aspirated engine rules, tons of manufacturers were entering F1 at this time, and Colony struck a deal with one. Subaru wanted to follow Honda and Yamaha into F1, and they struck a deal with Enzo Colony's team for exclusive use of their new engine. Subaru had subcontracted Motori Moderni, who had previously worked with Minardi, the team the Subaru engine was initially built for, and they built a Boxer 12 60 valve engine, very unlike anything else of its era. The last time we had seen a Boxer engine or a flat engine in F1 was the very early late 70s, early 80s with Ferrari. It had been very quickly phased out since then.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Subaru even bought a half ownership stake in Colony as well, painted the cars, which was an update of the C3 called the C3B, in Subaru's parent company Fuji's colors red, white, and green. Bertrand Gachot, who had spent the last year driving for fellow backmarkers Onyx and Rial, would drive the lone Coloni car as they scaled back to one entry for 1990. However, because nothing good's allowed to happen in this story, much like Zach Speed the year before, who had also made a deal with a Japanese engine manufacturer with an experimental five-valve design for their engine, the Subaru engine was a complete unmitigated disaster. The target for the engine was 600 horsepower, but the actual number was closer to about 560, which was 600 was already about 40 horsepower down on most of the grid. So it was also 245 pounds overweight, well as being incredibly wide because it was a boxer 12. The airbox was removed. So maybe they were better without it.
Good signs.
Everything's looking up for Cologne. They replaced it with two small like snorkel intakes on the side pods, kind of unlike anything else of its time. Resulting in a car that was incredibly low and wide and had really long side pods. The car was a nightmare in development because the C3B had seen no testing besides a short shakedown at a local track before heading to Phoenix for the season opener.
Wow.
Like the whole Subaru engine deal was very late in the off season, and the car was barely ready for Phoenix. The car was over 10 seconds off pace in practice. It was a mammoth 3 minutes, 43.718 seconds off pre-qualifying time, but it was due to the shift linkage breaking on the first lap of pre-qualifying. So he basically spent the entire lap stuck in like second gear.
Still a fantastic stat.
Yeah. Almost 4 minutes
that
off pace.
Amazing. Like screw the context. That's a fantastic stat.
Yeah.
That is amazing. 4 minutes off. Beautiful.
Not seconds, minutes.
Sorry. Yeah.
I mean, that's
I'm pretty sure the lap time too was like a minute 14. So
that is art. Yeah. That is art. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Also a quick tangent. The Phoenix Grand Prix was also an unmitigated disaster. And I believe the 1991 race was famously outdrawn spectators wise by a local ostrich race. So people were more interested in seeing ostriches race than Formula One.
That is
Oh my God. That's an actual story.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Leave it to
Arizona.
Yeah.
Honestly, yeah. You're right.
You know I don't like the American Southwest. Well, there's why.
There's a prime example.
Yeah. One of several reasons.
Not surprised at all.
On top of being wildly down on power, the massive weight of the engine made the car a handful to drive. With Gachot having a wild spin in Canada, which is that picture of where you can barely even see his seatbelts, where he's in the air. The car failed to pre-qualify for the first 8 races before the relationship between Coloni and Subaru had completely broken down. Upset with the development of the car, Subaru decided to try to buy out Enzo Coloni, who had allegedly signed the team over but refused to actually hand the team over to Subaru. So for the weekend of the Canadian Grand Prix, Enzo spent that weekend in Japan trying to work out a deal with Subaru's ownership, while Christian Vanderblin, the designer they had lured away from AGS, who had then quit and gone back to AGS, was rehired to manage the team while Enzo was in Japan.
Did we try this, fellas?
It honestly seems like he's just like bouncing between two abusive relationships.
Didn't we try this, fellas? What's going on? Unreal.
After the French Grand Prix, though, Subaru announced that it was just pulling out of the deal, and the British Grand Prix was the last time an F1 car ran with Subaru power.
Wow.
So instead of, they decided they weren't going to try to take over the team. They were just like, take it. We don't want it anymore.
That's incredible.
The team had been working on another evolution of the chassis, this time returning the airbox. But when the Subaru deal was axed, the team reinstalled their old Ford Cosworth engines from the year before, brought out the new car, the C3C. It was now repainted back in Coloni's signature bright yellow, but almost completely devoid of any sponsor logos. And while the car was an improvement, it was not by much. Gachot had 2 more DNP queues with the new car, before the folding of Onyx meant that Coloni only had to beat the hopeless Life team, which had somehow made it onto the grid by this point, and the increasingly uncompetitive Eurobruns to make it out of qualifying. Gasho managed to do so for the final six rounds of the season, but he failed to qualify each time as well, ending the season as one of only two teams to not qualify for a single Grand Prix.
Wow.
Other team being Life, of course.
That's crazy.
So 1990 had not gone well, and things are very quickly going wrong for Coloni.
Something that strikes me, comparing world events or other racing series to Formula One back in the day, when you think about like Formula One in, let's say, 1969, and also pair that with the fact that we went to the moon in 1969, it just seems a world away. Like, it seems like, you know, the things they were doing at NASA with, you know, Saturn V rocket and landing people on the moon and driving around a little electric buggy on the moon, compare that with just the raw horribleness of so many Formula One cars, obviously in the 60s, but then now even in the 90s when the space shuttle program is in full swing at this point. The space shuttle program is in full swing at this point. And you've got teams like this out here on a Formula One grid. It's fascinating to me to make that parallel. It's just incredible.
Yeah. So entering 1991, Coloni was in shambles. They had only made the grid five times in the last two seasons, and the Subaru deal had completely blown up in their faces, and their driver, Bertrand Gasho, was on the brand new Jordan Grand Prix team.
Good for him.
Bertrand Gasho also would famously, during that year, get it, I believe he assaulted a taxi driver, which resulted in him getting arrested, which allowed Michael Schumacher to make his F1 debut.
There you so go.
You can in a roundabout way, thank Coloni for Michael Schumacher. So
you know, and that's something that I've always noticed. I want to get into 1991 here, but real quick, I always notice this about F1. Everything connects, everything intermingles, everything leads to something else. There's even from the most bottom of the barrel nonsense team like this, like in its worst season, there's still somehow managed to be that connection to one of the greatest Formula One drivers of all time. I love that about F1. It seems like everywhere I look, there's facts and little tidbits like that. But I just really enjoy that.
It is funny how that works out.
Yeah.
To replace Gasho, Enzo Coloni allegedly pursued Andrea De Cesaris, who was one of the great journeymen of F1, whose Marlboro sponsorship would have done wonders. But Andrea signed to drive the other Jordan car alongside Gasho. So in the fall of 1990, Portuguese driver Pedro Chaves, who was on his way to winning the British F3000 championship that year, would test the C3C and would be signed on to drive for Coloni in 1991. Excuse me. Chaves brought sponsorship from Mateus Wines, who would be one of the very few sponsors on the new C4 chassis, which in reality was just a update of the C3C, which was an update of the C3B, which was an update of a car that debuted in 1988.
Oh my God.
So, or sorry, 1989.
Oh my gosh.
The team had ditched Coloni's signature yellow for a white, blue, and gray livery, but despite the sponsorship, the car was still nearly completely blank, with pretty much all of Coloni's sponsors running for the door after the Subaru partnership. 1991 also saw two new teams, the aforementioned Jordan Grand Prix, who, much like Coloni, were making the jump from lower formulas to F1, and the Lamborghini team racing under the confusing name Scuderia Modena Spa, who were also campaigning a former Coloni driver in one of their cars, Nicola Larini.
Just every time.
So, yep. The addition of these four cars meant that pre-qualifying would still be required, so Chavez would still have to get through the lottery before making it onto the grid. Unfortunately for Coloni, the C4 was merely an evolution of the C3, a car which had debuted back in 1989. And with Coloni's chronic lack of funds, the car had barely been developed during that time. It was slow, fragile, ill-handling, and paired with an F1 rookie, Coloni was regularly seen at the bottom of the pre-qualifying charts. Of the eight cars in pre-qualifying each week, Chavez only made it out of the bottom two in pre-qualifying once, and was slowest in 8 of his 13 appearances. After pre-qualifying 5 seconds slower than the next car, placing last in pre-qualifying in his home Grand Prix at Estoril, Chavez quit the team, leaving Colonia without a driver for the Spanish Grand Prix. While originally it was thought that Pedro's sponsorship was paying for his ride, he was actually supposed to be paid $100,000 for the season, but had only been paid 10 grand. So to the surprise of nobody, Colony hadn't tested a single time all season, and a desperately underdeveloped car was falling further and further behind. After skipping the Spanish Grand Prix, Colony signed reigning Japanese F3 champion Naoki Hattori to run the final two races of 1991. Fellow backmarkers AGS had run out of money at this point and decided to not make the trip to Japan, meaning that Naoki only had to beat 2 other cars to pre-qualify. However, he wouldn't even get close. Hattori was 17 seconds slower than Gabriele Tarquini's Fond Metal in fourth, and nearly 19 seconds slower than Martin Brundle's Brabham at the top of the pre-qualifying sheet.
Oh my god.
And 25 seconds off Gerhard Berger's eventual pole time.
Oh my god.
Like, that is insane.
Yeah.
We laughed at a Haas that's, you know, a second or second and a half off pace of pole time. My goodness.
Yeah. A rookie driver in a desperately underfunded car, driving at one of the most difficult tracks on the circuit was definitely a recipe for disaster. The season ending Australian Grand Prix didn't go much better for Colony, as a highly competitive pre-qualifying field saw the top 4 drivers separated by just 0.4 of a second, though Hattori was a further 4.5 seconds off fifth. While Chavez had been able to stay within 1 to 2 seconds of the rest of the field for most rounds, Hattori had been hopelessly off pace in the worst car on the grid. And with that, 1991 was brought to a close. While Ayrton Senna was celebrating his 3rd world championship, Enzo Colone's team was licking its wounds. Not only did Colone end the season as the only team to not qualify a single time, they didn't pre-qualify once. Pedro Chavez and Naoki Hattori found themselves at the very bottom of the driver standings, and unsurprisingly, Colony had finished 19th and dead last in the Constructors' Championship. While Naoki Hattori returned to his home country to run Japanese F3000, Enzo Colony found himself with no drivers, money, sponsorship, or race appearances in the last 2 years. In total, Colony had only qualified for 14 of their 81 Grand Prix appearances, failing to qualify in nearly 83% of their entries, and were only classified finishers 4 times, none of which came after their first full season in 1988. Wow. Enzo had had enough and returned to his stomping ground in Italian Formula 3. So that would bring his time in F1 to a close.
That's quite the time in Formula 1.
That's quite the time, all right.
I mean, it's fascinating to hear. This is not like these are people who well, I'm not gonna say didn't know what they were doing, but I mean, with all the success they had in Italy and everything like that, I mean, that must have been just such a shock. I mean, to go from stomping the field, winning championships, or at least finishing top 3 in points at least, just, I mean, not even qualifying for the race, not even qualifying for the qualifying of the race. I mean, that's absurd.
Yeah, that tends to be a running theme with a lot of the teams during this era, which jumped up from junior formula, as they very quickly found out that running a customer chassis and developing your own, way different.
Yeah.
Very difficult to design a car from scratch.
That's wild.
Wow.
Colony, after leaving F1, would continue to be a hotbed for future F1 talent throughout the 90s, with future minority driver Esteban Tuero running for the team in 1996. Esteban Tuero is also a quick tangent right here. Was a really highly rated prospect, made his debut in 1998 and like did all right. He was driving for Minardi. And then on the eve of 1999, he just retired out of the blue, and he's never given a reason why. He injured his back slightly midway, or not slightly, but he injured his back at like the second to last race of the season. And while he was rehabbing, he was just like, I don't want to do F1 anymore. And he's just never told why he retired.
Huh.
What the?
Yeah.
So. That's a story. Okay.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Quick little tangent, because that probably won't be a full episode. So, in 1997, Coloni tried his hand at International F3000 again, finally returning to the front of the grid in 2002 when future F1 driver Giorgio Pantano finished runner-up to Sebastian Bourdais by only 2 points. The following two seasons would see Coloni field two more future F1 drivers, Zolt Baumgartner and Patrick Friesacher. I'm pretty sure that's how you pronounce his last name. Mm. As well as test drive legend Shanok Nissany. Do you guys know, have you ever seen his one highlight?
I've heard his name. I'm pretty sure I have seen the highlight.
I've only heard of Roy, so I don't.
Yeah, his son Roy is running in F2 right now. Shanok Nissany, though, he's the only Israeli driver to ever get in an F1 car. And during his, I believe it was 2004, he was testing in free practice and he spun off into the gravel and he couldn't figure out how to get the steering wheel off the car. So they just craned the car off the track with him still
with
him
in it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was still in it. That's right.
Yeah, he couldn't remember how to take the steering wheel off. So they were like, well, we got to get the car off the track. So
I remember that. I remember seeing that. Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Following the discontinuation of F3000 after, I believe, 2005. Or no, after 2004, Coloni joined the new F1 feeder series GP2. They spent a number of years supported by F1 driver Giancarlo Fisichella before they bought out Giancarlo's stake in 2009. Unfortunately, they didn't really have any notable F1 drivers. They had, I believe it was Antonio Pizzonia, who was a former F1 driver, drove for them. But Friesacher would be the final F1 future driver that would run for them. In 2012, though, during the Silverstone round of the GP2 championship, Coloni mysteriously announced that they were pulling out of the championship at the end of the year and forfeited all the points they had scored that season. No further explanation was given, and that was the end of Scuderia Coloni.
Hmm.
Yeah. What? They just never gave a reason for why they exited the championship. God, much like Esteban Tuero, they were just like, I don't want to do this anymore.
There's so many... mysteries, and as a
yeah I
don't know, we just want to know, like, I don't know, I just want to know, you know?
Wow. Unsolved mysteries.
Yeah,
what on earth?
Yeah,
oh my God. I mean, okay, bye.
Yeah.
See ya.
This, however, would not be the end of the Coloni C4 chassis that they ran in 1991. After the end of 1991, Enzo sold his F1 team's operations to an eccentric Italian shoe designer by the name of Andrea Sassetti, who would attempt to enter the car at the season opener for 1992. Now painted solid black, the car showed up to the first race of the season with the name of Sassetti's shoe company emblazoned on the side pods, Andrea Moda. But that is a story for another time. So.
Hey.
Wow. Wow, wow,
and
wow,
that man. Was Coloni F1.
Oh, wow.
I didn't think that it could get that way, but it got that way.
Mm-hmm.
It really got that way.
For those of you wanting to know more about Andrea Moda, it is a fabulous story, one that completely goes beyond like what you would expect from a racing team, and I cannot wait to cover them on a future episode.
Fascinating. This is one of the better teams we're going to talk
about. Yeah, and Coloni's like one of the more well-run teams and that we'll be covering.
Fascinating.
I can only imagine the pure comedy that we're going to get at some point soon with these.
Oh, the Life Andrea Moda and MasterCard Lola episodes are going to be gold.
Wow.
So,
I think, you know, to kind of give my perspective on things, as somebody who is definitely one of those that likes older racing, and I'm more familiar with old NASCAR, not so much Formula One. But like I mentioned earlier, just what a romantic time. I know that like there's so many failures and just horrible teams, and the safety wasn't all there, and I know that that's not great or anything. But man, I don't know. To be a part of that just seems like, at least for a little bit, just seems like such an invigorating time. I mean, so much hope for all these new engine manufacturers, for the new teams. Maybe you could be something. And in the case of Coloni, and I'm sure we'll see later on, that's never going to happen. But I mean, still,
yeah.
just that there was the opportunity, at least, for these teams to come and compete, I think is something that's very, very attractive to me. And I really do wish we had today. I understand why they do it the way they do, but man, it's just too cool.
Yeah.
It's just too cool.
There's sort of like a Wild West energy to F1 at this time where it's just like, hey man, I got $1 million, so let's go get some Cosworths and some tires and throw them in this chassis that my buddy built in his garage and let's see if we can make the race.
Yeah, and like I spoke on it, and like I don't have to explain it all again, just how different, you know, the presentation of F1 is from then to now. But it, I mean, really, you look at like this story, and it's like they're playing $1 million club racing. Like,
yeah,
it's like it's literally like $1 million club race in club racing series that just happens to travel around the world. I mean, like, it is exactly like that. These guys, like, I mean, this is shoestring of a shoestring. Like, this is like bare minimum, and it's not even the worst one that we're gonna get to. I love it. I adore it.
It's fascinating that they, I mean, again, like you mentioned, that they're going around the world doing this. I mean, you got to pay for shipping that car and housing all those people and meals and like just everything. Like, that's just so much to it. How do they do that at that time too? You know, you don't have an internet or anything like that. You know, I mean, that's crazy.
That's the part that gets me about these stories. It's like the end of a grueling season where you haven't pre-qualified a single time. And then it's like, all right, load up the cars. We're going all the way across the world to Japan now. Maybe we'll make it.
Insane. Insane.
Oh my gosh. So that was the story of Colony F1. And the first episode of Disqualified. Next week, or whenever we end up making the next episode, we will be covering Colony's kind of, I wouldn't say blood brothers, but partners in misery during the same time, which would be the ill-fated Eurobrun team, which was the ill-fated partnership of a sports car racing team and a junior formula team coming together to make an unholy union of terrible F1 cars.
I loved it. I had a lot of fun. I am going to love this. I think this is going to be great. I cannot wait for more of these. I seriously can't. Like, I am like giddy at this story. That is fabulous.
It's fascinating. Oh, yeah. And man, it definitely gets me going. I want to hop in AMS2 and do some early 90s F1 at Adelaide or something. I know. Now.
Like, it really makes me want to drive, like, find a mod that has these crappy F1 cars in it and drive them.
I think there's a mod for the Life F or
an R Factor,
F190. Yeah,
Michael.
Mikey messes around with it a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so
I'm sure he'll be excited when that episode comes out.
Yeah.
So.
Oh man.
So on that note, any closing thoughts, you guys?
Man, put an airbox on your car until you realize you don't need to. Then don't do it.
Yeah. Airboxes overrated. Because Colony were doing all right until they put it on their car. And then...
Oh my God, that has to be the title of this podcast. Airbox is overrated? ? All caps.
And it's got like the thumbnail on it. So
If you've got a brand new wing that makes you fast, and you only got one of them, be very careful. Stay away from Eddie Cheever.
Stay away from Eddie Cheever.
That's the only piece of advice I can give you.
Noted hater of aerodynamic developments, Eddie Cheever.
Also, very careful.
Also, try your hardest to get the nickname The Wolf, because that is amazing.
That's
cool. Dude.
I hope I can come up with a logo as cool as Colony's logo someday.
God, I wish.
It is really cool. Like, maybe if there's a thumbnail or something, it'll be on there. But if you have not seen it, look it up. It is the coolest racing team logo I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. And on that note, or actually, do you guys have anything you want to plug before we go?
Make sure you get in. I know if you're here, you're probably already in the JTN social stuff. But if you're not, get in some of the JTN social stuff. Follow Fake Racers on Twitter, that account's probably going to tweet about this podcast and the Fake Racers podcast. JTN2 is the home for this podcast. Excuse me, in video format, and I'm sure we'll post it in audio form on podcast platforms, various ones, whichever those ones are. I guess whoever uploads that will figure that out, and I'll help or whatever. But that's all I got. I mean, I guess you can follow me at Davy Hazard on Twitter, at D7H5 on Instagram, at D7H5er on Twitch with an ER at the end, mind you. I'm going to be streaming the 24 hours of Daytona, 2 a.m. Friday night, Saturday morning, whatever you want to say. I'm not going to discriminate against you. Hopefully my computer doesn't catch on fire. That's the main goal. And we're going to have a good time. Our car looks beautiful. Shout out to Steven Merzlak with Apex Graphics. And Tommy, take it away.
Yeah, I'll be joining Davey behind the wheel. Hopefully we do better than a Coloni. If you're listening this far, you already know who I am, so I'm not going to do anything except for say donate to your local animal shelters. Cats are people too.
Yeah.
Oh, shut up. Shut up. Jesus.
Last but not least, I'm on Twitter at mstielman51, where you can see me complain about the Dallas Cowboys and or Cleveland Browns on there. also, make sure to send Joe all of your love for allowing this show to happen and giving us this platform to do it on. And like Dave said, make sure to listen to the Fake Racers podcast if you want to hear more of Davey and I. And this has been Disqualified. I will see you next time.
See you guys. Thank you.
Bow.